Bill, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
When I was a kid?
Yeah.
It was all over the place. I don't think I had any one particular passion in mind until I was about 15, and then I started playing music. And then I knew, within a month, I knew that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, was to be a musician. And so since that time, that's what I've done. I'm still a professional musician.
And how did you discover the Alexander Technique?
Well, I began to have some rather serious problems with the functioning of my left hand. I'm a saxophonist, and for a couple of years, my technique was just getting kind of more and more inconsistent. My coordination was getting more and more inconsistent. And what I found is I would probably be diagnosed. I'd never had a formal diagnosis from a neurologist, but my internal medicine doctor thought that I had a focal dystonia, which is a kind of a neurological blip where the brain just doesn't shut off certain muscles. And so for musicians, this sort of strikes about 1 in 500 professional musicians. And it manifests itself as kind of uncontrolled gripping through particular muscles that you use to play your instrument. In my case, it was the left hand, because both hands are busy on the saxophone, but the left hand seems to be particularly busy, especially through the wrist. So I was having some real problems with this, and just coincidentally, if there is such thing as coincidence, I was reading, I picked up Pedro de la Contra's book, Indirect Procedures, which is a great book about the Alexander Technique for musicians. And I read that book, and it resonated with me deeply because there was no theory to it. It was you know, it's sort of like, here's the truth. You have your thinking, you have your organism, and you have habit, and you have choice. And so, you know, it's up to you to make these changes. So I began to take lessons. I began to study with Francis Marsden, and it wasn't very long in the lessons. Not only did I begin to really improve in my condition in terms of my playing, that was a fairly slow thing, but I could see fairly shortly on that it was beginning to change. And I was just very impressed with the work, with the efficacy of the work, and I was beginning to see how broadly helpful the work was. It began to change many other aspects of my life, you know, everything from how I managed relationships to how I communicated with people to how I approached problems to how I exercised to how I did everything. And so, you know, I just decided to become a teacher, so I started training.
So how did Alexander Technique affect the way you related to other people?
Well, I have, and this is something still, as long as I have a tendency to react very quickly. And so in my relationships, it was, we put it in that kind of Alexander lingo, a lot of end gaining, not much inhibition, you know. Very quick to react, sometimes not really thinking out carefully enough the answers that I give people when I communicate with them. And so what really began to change as I started studying the Alexander Technique was just that beautiful power that you get to realize that you can pause for a moment and that you can make a choice about how you wish to react. And in my case, that's still a life, it's like a lifelong effort. You know, I'm getting better and better at that. And when things don't go wrong for me, it's still typically because I didn't inhibit, I didn't wait, I didn't, you know, I begin to end game. And so, again, this is how I begin to change things in my relationship with my son in particular. And it's very easy for parents to react very, very quickly and strongly to their children, of course. And with him, I really begin to give both him and me a lot of space in terms of how we were communicating. I think I began to listen a lot better and give myself a chance to really take him in, as opposed to always feeling like I was the leader and the only sole guidance in his life. So it's been very nice for me and my son.
How did the technique affect you emotionally?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. That's an interesting question, because I know that when many people train to become teachers, there's often this big emotional shift. And I've even seen in my teaching experience sometimes some huge emotional things take place in my students at the lessons. But for me, I don't think there was anything hugely significant emotionally about the technique. I don't know if there's anything that's really of note there. I think that the bigger thing for me was just it's calmed me down quite a bit, and it's helped me think a little bit more clearly. So I guess if I put that into an emotional context, I would say that I'm probably less likely to be at the risk of simplifying to be over emotional sometimes, that perhaps my responses to things are a little bit better balanced than they were before.
So how did you find the process of devoting 3 years to training to become an Alexander teacher?
You mean the training itself, the process of the training? It was wonderful. I still look back on it with just tremendous fondness. I felt, first of all, very very fortunate to have studied there at ATI because there was such a diverse, yet, in my opinion, a congruent array of teaching ideas coming from the different teachers teaching there. And, you know, I felt very well trained there, felt very confident with my training. And I also felt that the environment there between the teachers and the students, even though it was always a shifting environment, of course, as students come and go and things change, but always felt very very supported there, very very held. Yeah, I don't know how else to describe it. You know, it was a bit of a sanctuary whenever I was there. I lived quite far. I had a commute. It was about an hour and a half to hour to 2 hour commute to get there in the morning. Actually, it wasn't that far. It was just terrible traffic. And I, of course, didn't like that. But the moment I got into those doors, I felt very, very good for 3 hours. I never, ever got tired of the training. It was nothing but interesting to me all the way to the end. And when I finished, I really felt that I was, in many ways, was just beginning. You know, I felt that I was a competent beginner, I guess you would say. And, you know, if it weren't a question of time, money, and the realities of life, I would have been very happy to just keep training. You know, I was very, very happy there.
And how was the process of establishing yourself as a teacher of the technique?
Well, that's, you know, for those who know me well know that as a musician, for example, my musical colleagues know that it's not my nature to do marketing. You know, I don't get out there and kind of put myself out there that much. I sort of wait for the work to come to me. But I've made exceptions here in the Alexander technique because first of all, as you would venture to guess, many people don't even know what the work is. They have no idea what it is. And so I realized very early on that what I needed to do was get fairly active with some of my marketing efforts. And so I did that. And between starting the marketing efforts rather early, that is, you know, putting up a website immediately, getting a beautifully done brochure, trying to get out into the community and kind of do seminars and things like that, talking to physical therapy offices and chiropractic offices and personal trainers and various other people, Pilates teachers and various other people that might have clients that might be interested in this work. I also started teaching in the community at the local YMCA, and that was a very good opportunity. At the beginning was getting several private students, and their friends were telling their friends, and so on and so on. And so I was sort of fortunate at the beginning, was I was able to build a little bit of momentum and keep that going. And so even with my marketing efforts now, I still think that I've got to say that 90% or more of my clients have all come to me from word of mouth, you know, from other students who've been happy with the work.
What is your description of the Alexander technique for somebody who's never heard of it?
Well, if somebody's never heard of it, I probably would try to start off very simply and say that, you know, in the simplest sense, what I do is I teach people how to become aware of and prevents unnecessary and potentially harmful muscular tension as they carry out their activities. And if they want to know more, then I'll elaborate from there. I'll talk about things like habit. As a musician, one of the real values, and I would say more than half of my students are musicians, because I'm a musician. Habit is a big thing with musicians. You know, we need habit. And yet habit is the very thing as a creative person that can also kind of sink you, too. So I also look at the work as something that really is a clear way to begin to understand and address our habits, not just what we do muscularly or what we do through our body, but our habits of thinking, our habits of how we, as an artist, how you would imagine something artistically, as an improvising musician, how you would think about the music, connecting the idea of gesture, that is physical gesture, with emotion and thought, and seeing how even that manifests itself as habit. So this idea, again, that it's really a way to really begin to understand habit is another way that I really understand and sort of teach the work and think about the work.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So when did you graduate?
I graduated in 2006.
And how long did it take? Yeah, go ahead.
In 2006, I think at the beginning of 2006, I want to say, was it whenever that term ends in January, I guess, yeah.
And how long did it take you to get a practice going?
Immediately. I mean, I taught three practice students, and two of them continued with lessons after they did their 10 lessons, and then one of them, of my practice students, who's still with me today, still taking lessons, started sending many people my way. He's a well-respected cosmetic dentist in Beverly Hills, so he started sending many people my way. Sometimes people had TMJ issues, he would send my way. So really from the get-go, I would say after I'd been teaching for about 6 months, I was probably doing about anywhere from 6 to 10 lessons a week. And it doesn't necessarily grow much from there, I have to say. It comes and goes. I mean, anybody who has a practice like this will probably tell you that it rises and falls. There's some weeks when I'm very busy teaching privately, and there's other weeks when I'm less so. And this is, you know, of course, I'm balancing my Alexander teaching career also with my musical career, with my music teaching career, and I also have kind of a part-time, I guess you'd say, an academic career where I teach the Alexander Technique at the American Musical and Dramatic Academy in Los Angeles, which is a BFA program for performing artists. So I do that. So I manage to stay fairly busy.
So what advice would you give to a new teacher of Alexander Technique who wants to develop a private practice?
I think it's important from the get-go. We live in this digital age we live in now. I think it's very important to get the work known and get yourself known. So certainly getting a website up, using social media, using things like Facebook and Twitter and things like that. Networking, if you're comfortable doing that. Responding on other people's blogs. One of the things that's really led a lot of students my way in the last, really about a year, I'd say, is just I started blogging. And so I'm getting lots of musicians now because I have a blog that's written specifically about the Alexander Technique in music. And that's sent a lot of people my way. So I would say for the new teachers, really understand, you know, what your interest is. Speak to that interest. You know, go to meetings, go to any kind of networking events. Don't be afraid to talk to Pilates teachers. Don't be afraid to talk to physical therapists and other modalities where they, you know, you might have people that are interested in what you do. And just be very persistent about that. One good bit of advice I've heard, I believe that Pamela Blanc said this, and it's a great bit of marketing advice. At the beginning of your practice, you know, figure out how many hours you would really like to work per week in the Alexander technique. You know, so let's say you'd really like to be, you'd be very happy, let's say, teaching 20 hours a week, for example, and just giving an arbitrary number. But in that first week, you only have one or two students, so you're really only working 2 hours, right? So what Pamela would say is then spend the rest of that time doing something with your marketing, so whatever that is. But get out there and get very active with that. And eventually you'll be working more, that is teaching more and marketing less, and you'll probably start getting some momentum. And I think you always have to market to a certain degree, but for someone like myself who does not really enjoy doing that, you do, I believe, you get a momentum. I mean, you get things going, and as I mentioned, that most of my work is now referral work. And I think that with any successful teacher, that's ultimately what's going to happen, is you're going to just get referral after referral after referral.
Was there a moment when you realized, hey, I'm a pretty good teacher of the Alexander Technique, or I can really do this?
You know, I don't know if there ever was a moment there. It's my nature sometimes to not be secure with myself. I mean, I can have a lot, you know, I've been playing music for many years, but I can still get grave doubts about myself as a musician. And there's no reason to, of course. This is all habits of thinking. So when I first started teaching, when I graduated, I felt very confident because my practice students did very well, and I felt confident in my training. And in the first few months of teaching, it was, you know, it's a different experience because when you do your training there, you're working with people who sort of know the drill in many ways. You know, you're working with people who already have very good direction and already know how to move fairly well and already have great, you know, pretty good developed, fairly accurate sensory awareness. And then when you get out there and you start working in the real world, you find everybody's completely different and a huge range of capacity that people have. You have some people that just, you know, after six lessons still can't figure out where their hip joints are, you know. And so for me, I don't think I ever had this moment of, oh my God, I'm good, I can really do this. I think it's just been a cumulative where I see, you know, many successful cases of people come, the problems have been addressed very well, they're very happy with the work. And what I tend to do is rather than think, oh, gee, I know how to do this, because I actually do feel fairly confident in my ability to teach, I guess I feel, as I go on in the Alexander Technique, it's not so much that I become more confident in my teaching ability, it's that I become even that much more confident, or I should say confident, in the work itself. As long as I stay with the principles of the work and I keep working by principle, you're going to get good results. It's as simple as that. And so even if I do have a situation where I might not feel quite so confident, and that really doesn't happen nowadays, but I'm thinking maybe in the first year or so when I was teaching and if I had an opportunity to go speak somewhere or go teach a seminar, you know, I would feel sometimes not that confident. And then what I would always remind myself is, you know, be confident in the work because the work works. And so as I go farther along with it, that's really where the confidence is. It's just sticking to principle and seeing that if you do over and over, you're going to have very, very good results. And no matter what comes your way, you're going to be able to deal with that as long as you stay with principles, because the principles simply apply to every person in every situation virtually.
So what are your biggest challenges when you teach the Alexander Technique?
I would say always my biggest challenge is to contain myself. I tend to do things with a great deal of enthusiasm, and when I teach, my enthusiasm sort of has to be held into check. You know, I can that can manifest itself sometimes as a little bit of end gaining. It's sort of sometimes maybe giving the student more information that they need to have, or maybe not really kind of dancing well with the student's energy. And so I have to, when I teach, I'm very conscious about this when I teach, is to, when I get very happy about how something went in a lesson, you know, is to not do the, what we call the proverbial end zone dance, where we're kind of thinking, yeah, you know. I mean, I want to encourage my students, of course, always, but I always wanted to do this in a very calm way so that they themselves are not end gaining. Of course, as you know, it's very easy for them to think that, oh, now I figured it out. This is what I have to do. And, of course, that's the last thing we ever want them to try to think when we teach the Alexander Technique is what they have to do. We just want them to become aware of what they need not do and have them go down that path. So, yeah, for me, I would say it's that. It's containing my emotions.
Do you find yourself getting bored teaching the technique?
Not for one second. Not ever. I've never been bored. It's, for me, endlessly fascinating, largely because, I guess for two reasons. Probably first because I know that if someone stays with the work and we stay on principle, that the person that came to me for help is definitely going to be helped. And that in itself is so fulfilling and so rich to me that I don't think I could ever get tired of that. And the second, probably the second reason why I think I would never get bored is that every single person that comes to you is kind of like a new puzzle. It's a new mystery to be solved. And even though we're staying with the principles of the technique to solve this mystery, it's still a mystery. You know, there's no such thing, of course, as a formula to teach. The way the words go into one person goes into another person completely differently. Even the use of the hands. I mean, sometimes the direction is very clear in my hands, but the student is not accepting the direction from my hands in this way. So I have to think, you know, what can I do in a different way to get them to be able to accept that direction? And so it's for me, that's just endlessly fascinating to see how can I reach into this person? How can I use these principles to reach into this person and help this person? And I would easily say I've never had a moment of boredom in the Alexander Technique teaching.
What do you think of the Alexander world? Is there anything about the world of those who devote themselves to teaching the technique that you find as interesting?
I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say that there's anything that really comes to mind or stands out like that. I tend to be sort of... probably to a fault, I tend to be a little bit insular sometimes. And even though I like to keep up with my studies and my reading, I'm always reading Alexander's books. I'm always reading books on neurobiology that have to do with the Alexander Technique. I'm always, read many articles and blogs about the Alexander Technique and like to take in these ideas. But I wouldn't say that I'm really deeply connected to the Alexander community. I'm not proud of that. That's just sort of my nature. I tend to be a little insular that way. So I don't really. I've never been to an AGM, which I'm kind of. You know, it's not a. Again, nothing I'm proud to say, but it's just. I don't gravitate towards things like that. I tend to like learning things from individually with people and kind of learning things on my own in a different way sometimes. So I wouldn't say that I even have a vast perception of kind of the Alexander community at large, other than I'd have to say there's a few, you know, blogs that I've read that I really, really enjoy reading that are written by Alexander Technique teachers that I read religiously because I find them very interesting and very satisfying.
Which ones?
I really like Jennifer McCarris, is that her name? I'm trying to think of her last name. She's over in the UK. And she writes a tremendous, tremendously beautiful blog, always quoting Alexander's work and tying it just immediately into relevant things. And not just the simple nuts and bolts of how we move better and move easier, but even bigger things, you know, how we relate to people, how we deal with fear, things like that. So I enjoy her blog quite a bit. And, you know, from time to time, I, I always like to visit, of course, Robert Rickover's gigantic website and find various articles and things that are interesting there. And he himself, Robert, when he used to blog, which he really doesn't blog anymore, he wrote some really lovely things. He's written a lot of, to me, very useful things that I've read and kept and pondered.
How do you like blogging?
I love blogging. I actually do because I, for a couple of reasons. First of all, I don't care that I'm good. I have no kind of vested emotional interest in it. You know, I don't worry if it's good or bad. I would say I don't care if it's good or bad, but I don't have, I don't stress or sweat it. The blog I have now, I literally just write things that are interesting to me, and I'm hoping that they're helpful, and they are. I mean, I have a lot of followers, and you know, some of the articles I've written on my blog have gone almost, in a small sense, have gone viral. I had an article that had, you know, for several days was having about 1,000 page views a day on this one article, and so I like blogging, and I like doing what I do with the blog because I simply write what's interesting to me based upon how I think about the Alexander technique and how it relates to music and my experience with that as well. And part of what I write about on my music blog isn't just about things directly about the Alexander technique, like, you know, taking care of our use and things like that. But I also write about broader aesthetic issues. I'm a jazz musician, so I have a real strong passion about the idea of authentic self-expression as opposed to, you know, mimicking others. So I'll very often write articles kind of getting people to kind of rethink how they think about making music so that they're kind of able to come to music with a different point of view and play with a little more courage and play with the idea of really giving themselves a chance to find their own voice. And, so these are the things I like to write about. These are the things I'm passionate about. And, so it's really a great pleasure to write. And, as I said, wonderfully enough, my writing seems to help people. I get lots of feedback from it. And even, strangely enough, even getting work, I get work via Skype, by online, giving online music/Alexander lessons. I've got a student in Austria now and a student over in Mauritania. You know, the world's getting smaller and smaller because of Skype. So,
wow.
Again, it's a nice thing because it goes right to the thing I love, which is being able to help and to really be able to share and spread this work. So the blog has been great. It's been a little kind of serendipitous gift to me. It's kind of turned into a much bigger thing than I thought that it would become.
What is it like teaching over Skype?
It's interesting. You know, at first I was reluctant to do it, and what I only thing I'll offer on Skype is I'll offer a 1 hour, what I call a 1 hour Alexander/movement assessment for musicians. In other words, I'll watch you play for an hour, and I'll give you a lot of feedback. I'll give you even a detailed kind of feedback of what some of your habits are, about how these habits are kind of interfering with your balance, and perhaps how these habits are kind of making playing more difficult rather than easy. But that's about as far as I'll go, and I'll say clearly you really need to, you know, have the hands-on work with the teacher. But as you know, there are some people that are just not served by a teacher. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles, perhaps, from a teacher. So what I do offer regularly are just music lessons via Skype through the lens of the Alexander technique. And one of my students, this gentleman over in Austria, already has an Alexander technique teacher in Austria that works with him. And he's just interested in mostly saxophone lessons via Skype with me because he wants to really understand more clearly how these Alexander ideas tie directly into playing the saxophone. And so it's been wonderful working with him because he sees more and more clearly each week. It's great because whatever he learns from his teacher always seems to be affirmed by what he learns from me. So I watch him. I give him ideas as he plays. We have a common language. I don't mean that we both speak English, but I mean we both speak, and you know, Alexander speak now too. So when we talk about noticing his head, neck, and back, noticing his head going back and down, noticing, you know, his shoulders or his torso narrowing, you know, he can immediately respond to that because he's had the kinesthetic experience from his teacher. But the thing that's most surprising to me by doing this, because I was semi-reluctant to do this, but the thing that's very surprising to me is actually how you can really help people improve without using your hands at all. You know, just by giving them clear information, by giving them things to think about, by giving them you know, ways to notice things in their body. And I've been sort of pleased with that. Just kind of, as I say, pleasantly surprised by how effective you can be teaching that way.
How do you structure your regular in-person lessons?
I probably don't structure them any particular way. I guess if there's a something typical would be someone coming in, and of course we connect and talk for a few minutes before I do anything at all with my hands. I want to figure out, you know, what's going on in their mind, what have they been thinking about during the week, what have they noticed, things like that. And then very often, just based upon what I gather in those first few moments, I have an idea of how I want to start proceeding. And that's usually all I know, is how I want to start proceeding. And from there, for me, in many ways, it's like being an improvising musician. You take it moment for moment, and you work. So, you know, I'm almost always wanting to start with somebody in just basic movement, how they're balancing. So I might do, you know, start with, of course, with some chair work and things like this. Maybe take that into some rotational work, getting them to kind of move in spiral ways, getting them to shift the weight through their body via their arms, various things like this. If they're a musician, then we will typically get right to their instrument, and you know, after about 15 minutes of maybe some chair work, we'll get maybe down to playing music for a little bit, and sometimes all we'll do with their instrument is just have them learn to sit with it for 5 or 10 minutes without tensing up and without throwing themselves out of balance. We might work a little bit on music there. Very often, at some point in the lesson, I like the students to have some lying down work, some table work. More often than not, it seems to end up close to the end of the lesson. Sometimes I'll start at the beginning of the lesson with that if someone really, after I talk to them for a few minutes, and it really seems to me that they'll most benefit from that. We'll start with table work. Sometimes with my musicians, I'll start them with table work because they'll come off the table very often and they'll play in a very different way. They'll kind of experience kind of a freer coordination immediately. And it piques their mind and piques their interest is, wow, why is this so much better? And then what I try to do is tie that into, well, it's because you've had an instant, you know, a few moments there of really coming back to you know, good ease and muscular balance, and you're starting your playing your instrument right from that point of view. And so, you know, I'll kind of mix it up various ways like that. I tend to just see what I think the student needs. One of the biggest things I learned when I was at ATI was from Lynn Charlson. She would always say, you know, you know, if she was working with me, if she was giving me a turn and I was being the teacher and working with the trainee there, she would always say this to me: what do you need to do to help this person right now? You know, what do you need right now to do to help them? How can you help this person right now? And that is really, really stuck to me in a big way. For me, that really works well, because if I approach every student when they come in with that point of view of how can I help them, it shifts me from anything that might be formulaic, and it brings me back to a place of, again, being an improviser, being, you know, taking in moment to moment what it is that they need, and you know, following their need instead of following kind of my preconception of, oh, but here's what I have to do to make it an Alexander lesson. You know, I have to do this. We have to do this much chair work. We have to do this much table work. We have to do this much, you know, whatever work we might think we have to do. And it gives me, when I think in this other way, it allows me to not kind of fall into anything like a pattern or anything formulaic like that.
Do you use traditional Alexander language such as inhibition and stop and say no?
Yeah, I do. And I do it very gradually, and I do it all through experience. I want them to notice something. They're going to notice a certain phenomenon. And then when they notice that phenomenon, I mean, when it's clear to me that they notice this phenomenon, you know, for example, I'm thinking today giving a woman a lesson, and when she really, it's about her third lesson, and she really began to sense herself beginning to tense up and going into her habit and stopping. She stopped all on her own. And she stopped, I could see in her eyes, I could see in her face that she stopped consciously. And so I asked her, I said, tell me what just happened there. She said, I was getting ready to go right into pulling my shoulders back to get out of the chair like I always do, and I stopped. And I said, well, we have a little lingo word for that in the Alexander technique. We call that inhibition. We call that conscious inhibition. And so I'll take a couple of minutes to describe this word inhibition and what it means within this context. And so that's usually how I use the terminology. And I know that some Alexander teachers don't even really like that word inhibition because it has these Freudian connotations of you know being suppressed or what have you. But I don't seem to be afraid of that. I think it's just a word. And as long as we can agree upon the meaning of that word within the context of what we're learning in the Alexander technique, I think it's fine. So most of my students will know about inhibition. They'll know about direction. Certainly awareness, faulty sensory perception. They'll know that because they'll see themselves in every lesson discovering more about that. And ends and means, you know, about really understanding, staying in the process, understand when we're end gaining. And so, yeah, those terms come up. But as I said, they come up just through the experience in the lesson. We're all going to end gain in the lesson. And that's when the student notices that they're end gaining, that's when I say, okay, we call this end game, you know, and we can talk about this, and we have a common operational language from which to proceed. And it also helps these students because as they go out into the real world, you know, with what they've learned from the Alexander technique, they'll see how universal these ideas are, how universal these concepts are, these principles are, and how they can be applied to much more than just how they balance themselves in a chair or how they work at their computer. They can, as I have, they can bring this into, you know, how they deal with other people, how they communicate, how they interface with the world, etc.
Do you have any theory why some people make rapid progress and other people make infinitesimal progress?
No, I don't. I think it's a very, very individual thing. I think generally speaking, the people that make quicker progress, age, I found in my experience, can have some to do with it. When I work with 20-year-old acting students, you know, within I can work with them for 3 or 4 minutes with my hands and get them in 3 or 4 minutes moving in a way that would take me a typical 60-year-old person 10 lessons to move. You know, they've come out of their habits very quickly because the brain doesn't have 60 years of that habit. And this is really all about, all this Alexander work really is about addressing the brain, how the brain immediately goes into these preset postural patterns and response patterns. It's much easier to bring a younger person out of this and bring them back into that natural good balance that they learned and developed when they were young. Having said that, typically if I'm working with many older people, the older person has a much greater willingness to pay attention. And it's interesting to me because even with that great willingness to pay attention, it may be a little harder to get this person to change. Not harder, but it's just going to probably take a little longer, mostly because these patterns are so hardwired. I think that the most difficult thing for some of these older people, it really is this faulty sensory awareness that it's still very difficult for them to understand when they're interfering with the primary control. It's difficult for them to really sense when they're going into their habit. So it seems to take just a little more work, a little more time. Everybody I've worked with can change. The only person that's not going to change is going to be someone who just doesn't want to, either doesn't want to change or doesn't want to do the necessary work to change. You know, someone, if someone comes in and is just absolutely unwilling to pay attention or doesn't care. You know, I've had mothers bring their 15-year-old daughters to my class at the YMCA because they hate their daughter's posture. Their daughter's slouching all the time and she looks terrible and all these things. And I graciously work as much as I can, but I see the same thing over and over. And these daughters don't care about changing. They have no interest in changing. It's not their need, so they typically don't change. I can within the class, I can bring them up with my hands. They'll follow my hands easily, and they'll come up, and they'll move better and all this. But the moment I take my hands off, they go right back to what they did before, and they don't care. So in my experience so far, usually the people that are slower learners in the technique it's either because either age or just condition or what have you, they have strong habits and a very, very highly developed, if you were, faulty sensory awareness. Or they just don't care. They're not interested in changing. But those seem to be the biggest obstacles as to why people don't move so well. It's never, to me, in my experience, had anything to do with what we might normally call intelligence or aptitude or anything like that. I've had some very bright people come in who had a very difficult time, you know, making changes, and I've had some people come in who were clearly not that bright but could change very, very easily, you know, because they can think simply about things and they can be open and they can be aware. So I can never imagine what... I could never probably come up with a theory as to exactly why some learn faster or slower, other than what I've just mentioned out of my own experiences.
You notice any male-female differences?
No, I would say no. When I first started teaching, the first 2 years of my teaching, my private teaching career, almost 100%, I would say like 95% of my students were women, were female. And that's changed now because I'm getting a lot more musicians. And with musicians, you have a lot of men and women. And so I would say about 50-50 in terms of gender now. But I wouldn't say specifically that men or women are different that way. I was tempted to say at the beginning, and I was even saying this in my training, that I thought that in my experience that women seem to be better suited even to teach this work. You know, they tended to me naturally to be more intuitive, more receptive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember mentioning that to Lynn Charleston. This was, you know, at the beginning of my training, this was just a kind of an idea I had, an observation. And she very calmly but politely set me straight on that. You know, she said, nope. He goes, I had some of the greatest teachers you're ever going to meet are men, and, you know, it has nothing to do with that. And I've sort of found that to be the case, too. I have less kind of an idea of it. About a woman learner versus a man learner than other things. There's probably other criteria that might be a little more discernible in terms of the difference between how people learn. But gender, probably not in my experience.
How popular do you think the technique can be with the general public? Could it ever be a mass movement akin to yoga?
You know... I'm going to sound like a real negative person, and I've heard this before, but I'm going to tell you squarely that I don't believe it ever will. Let me take that back. I don't believe it ever will until there is a radical shift in consciousness in kind of the human race, as it were. The main reason why I don't think this will ever take off and be wildly popular is because it really does demand a certain kind of responsibility and vigilance, maybe not just responsibility, but a certain type of vigilance that many people are just absolutely unwilling to adhere to. And I think even in my own personal experience, I had actually heard of the Alexander Technique probably 20 years before I took my first lesson. I didn't hear much about it. It was when I finally read Pedro de la Contra's book that I really began to understand what the work was. But as I started taking my first Alexander lessons and started getting into this work, I knew that had I come to that work when I was 24 years old, I would have never gone back to the second lesson. It would have just been nothing to me. I would have said, no, there's no way I'm going to pay attention like this. You know, I just don't care. So this idea of vigilance was, in my case, was easy when I came to it at an older age because I was feeling rather desperate. You know, I had a deep need, and I was willing to do anything to continue to keep playing my instrument. And so it was easy for me that way to be that vigilant. But I would say, I hate to say the average person, because in reality there probably is no average person, but many people just don't want to do what the work has them do. They don't mind many of these people don't mind going to a yoga class, and I see them where I teach at the YMCA. I see them going into the rooms, you know, 20 or 30 people into a giant yoga class, and they do their yoga for an hour, and they come out, and they come hobbling out. They come with this their old same old kind of crippled and bad looking use that they had when they went in there. But they feel good about it. They say, oh, no, I went to yoga, and I did, you know, my posture is going to be good, and life's going to be good because I did my yoga. And so, and yoga's wonderful. I'm not slamming yoga here. But many people don't mind doing that one-hour yoga class two or three times a week. It's akin almost to taking a pill. It's like you do your yoga, or you do your Pilates, or you go to the physical therapist, or you go to the chiropractor, then you forget about it. You know, then you're good. Life is good. And I've got to be very honest. In my process, when if I knew that that's all I had to do, versus, oh, you need to be vigilant all the time, heck no. I would choose that too. I'd say, let me take the pill. Let me do my one-hour class three times a week and never think about it. You know, the idea that you have to begin to, as I said, become vigilant and think about these things and be responsible for yourself all the time is something that I think that many people just aren't willing to do.
Yes. So if people want to learn more about your practice and your writing, they can just Google your name, Bill Flake, and Alexander Technique, or they can go to alexandertechniquefoothills.com.
They can go to my music blog. They can go to billflakemusic.org. Which is where, if you're a musician, that's where I would suggest that you go. If you're just a person interested in the Alexander Technique, yeah, either Google my name or go to alexandertechniquefoothills.com.
Is there anything that I should ask you about that I have not asked you about?
No, I think you've asked a very, very thorough interview. You've asked a lot of interesting questions, and many of the things you've asked are things that I don't think that I've ever specifically sat down and thought about. So it was kind of nice to have that chance to think about those things in a moment.
Okay, hang on one sec.